Hello, welcome to the September 2012 edition of the SANS and its Storm Centers monthly threat update. Sorry for the confusion about the timing we had this month. Usually we do it at 1 p.m. Eastern, which actually turns out to be sort of the ideal time to allow even Europeans and West Coasters to attend. We had actually planned to pre-record yesterday and just make a recording live because I had a conflict in my scheduling today. I had a class I had to teach. Now, the recording last evening didn't work out, so we had no other choice but to reschedule it for this evening. One of the rumors, of course, was that we delayed it because of the iPhone 5 announcement, but ever since they are without Steve Jobs, we usually don't reschedule webcasts for them. So anyway, let's get started with this month's threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich. Today I'm recording or speaking here in Baltimore, Maryland. With that, let's also acknowledge our sponsor, Core Security. Core Security sponsors this webcast now for a couple years already, and they don't ask to really speak or do anything to take away from our time. Instead, they just would like to be acknowledged as the sponsor of this particular webcast. Let's talk briefly about the outline for the webcast. As typically in these monthly threat updates, we talk about Microsoft patches. Of course, today, not a lot to talk about when it comes to Microsoft. We had a real nice and quiet patch Tuesday. With that, however, Microsoft pre-released an announcement about more restrictive key requirements that will come in effect in October. So we'll talk a little bit about that and why Microsoft sort of went out of its way to pre-release that change. When we're talking about keys, SSL is in the news again with new weaknesses against the protocol. So we'll talk a little bit about this announcement about a new tool called Grime that's officially going to be released, I believe, next week. So we'll share a little bit what we learned so far about this tool. And then, of course, just this week, GoDaddy had a big outage. Not really too much to talk about, but at least want to acknowledge it and talk a little bit about sort of some of the issues, particular more reliable DNS hosting. And then, finally, the issues, of course, we had with Java updates. So let's start with Microsoft patches. We only have two. Both of them were labeled important. One was in Visual Studio Team Foundation Server, that's MS-12061. And then we had one in System Center Configuration Manager, MS-12062. So a couple notable things here, only two, only important. And then the software that's being patched here is not your super widely deployed software like Office or Windows itself or Internet Explorer. Instead, it is, I would call them more niche products that, yes, you know, Visual Foundation Team Server, there are a lot of people using it. There are probably more people that use System Center Configuration Manager, but still, there are usually limited deployments of them, which makes this patch rather stress-free. There are not like thousands of desktops you have to worry about. There are just a couple of servers. First one is MS-12061 and, like I said, Visual Studio Team Foundation Server. First, a little bit about the software, if you're not familiar with it. The software itself is meant for development teams to get them organized. So it provides features like revision control, so developers can check in source code, but also provides project planning and a couple other features like this. Most of the time, the way I've seen deployed is sort of internal, where your developers and project managers and such connect to it. However, it does have some powerful features to also allow, for example, external customers to connect to it, to check on project status and submit tickets and things like that. So that's kind of the little summary of what the product does. If you don't develop in-house, in particular, if you don't have any large development team, you probably don't have Visual Studio Team Foundation Server. That's why I say it's not as widely deployed as a lot of the other Microsoft products. However, you know, pretty much any .NET shop out there or such probably has it set up. Now, the vulnerability itself is a cross-site scripting vulnerability. That, of course, is always a little bit tricky in the sense that cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, they're everywhere. They're often underestimated. There's a lot of bad stuff that you can do with a cross-site scripting vulnerability. In essence, you can control the user's browser, which in this case may be an administrator, may be a developer. And then it's really just up to the creativity of the attacker, what they're actually going to end up doing with this vulnerability. So don't underestimate it, but then again, the limited footprint should probably make patching rather easy. Next one is System Center Configuration Manager. Sort of similar to the Visual Foundation Server in the sense that it's an admin feature. Yes, a lot of corporations, a lot of networks use it to manage configurations across larger numbers of systems. But then again, you have one to install. You don't have thousands of them all over your enterprise. So the patch should be reasonably straightforward. It's another cross-site scripting issue, so two cross-site scripting issues this month, and everything I just said about cross-site scripting does apply in this case too. In this case, it's a reflective cross-site scripting, so the actual exploit has to be actually contained in the link that an administrator, for example, would click on. So not much really to patch, and I would actually think that there are a lot of Microsoft customers that don't have to patch a thing this month, and that's kind of unusual. Not sure when we had this the last time where you could really say, hey, 90% of Microsoft customers do not have to patch this month. Now, there were a couple of other patches I didn't include yet. They mostly affected ActiveX kilobits in Cisco products. Microsoft usually doesn't list them as patches because they really affect more these third-party products delivered by Cisco. But so if you do see patches being offered this month and you don't run these two products that are part of these bulletins, that may be why you're still getting a patch. So the big issue really is this SSL key update. What it really means is that starting in October, Microsoft will release a patch that essentially will switch the default policy that Windows uses to verify keys. Right now, SSL RSA keys may be as short as 512 bits. As of October, this will no longer be acceptable, and the minimum acceptable key length will be 1024 bits. So 1024 bits will still be okay. Now, why do you care? The problem is that you may not know how many of these short keys you actually need. It affects a ton of different systems. Like, for example, S/MIME I listed here, code signing, like ActiveX code signing. So you may have some software out there that's actually signed with a key that's too short after October, and now the signature validation will fail. One little safeguard Microsoft put in here is that any applications that were signed before January 1st, 2010 will still be okay, and their signatures don't have to be updated. I actually see this as a possible problem, because essentially the root cause is that these short keys, like these 512-bit and 768-bit keys, can be brute forced. Now, with that, an attacker could come up with fake key, and then of course they could sort of backdate the signing. The other issue that you'll run into is if you created your own certificates, and lots of people do that for code signing, nothing really wrong with it, but if you use the Windows 2008 R2, which is pretty much the latest out there, there are still three cryptographic services that came with Windows 2008 R2 that allow 512-bit keys. So they essentially have a certificate, a template associated with them that do allow these short keys. Doesn't mean that you necessarily use them. If you paid attention, you probably change that, but if you just accept default settings and create a quick key, it may end up being too short. Windows 8, on the other hand, it already comes with the right, and that's the 1024 key limit. Now, here are a couple of tricks on how you find these short keys. First of all, if you have certificate files and keys and such, the tool to use is CertUtil. CertUtil allows you to list all of the properties of keys, in particular these templates, and then you're looking for PKI minimal key size. So make sure that's at least 1024. If you have any public facing websites, it's a good idea anyway from time to time to go to ssllabs.com and plug in your own URL and have ssllabs.com check out your certificates. This goes way beyond the key length and it checks a number of other parameters, so certainly something to do once in a while. However, you can only do that with public facing websites. One thing to remember is that by default, ssllabs.com will make its results public on its website. If you don't want this, don't forget to check the opt-out checkbox. But then again, anybody can run ssllabs.com against your site. ssllabs.com doesn't really do anything a normal browser wouldn't do connecting to your site. Now, if you have internal websites that you're concerned about, I recommend looking at your existing vulnerability scanners. Nessus, for example, does have plugins that check certificate validation, key lengths, and things like that. So you can just add this to your regular vulnerability scan and make sure you don't have any bad certificates out there that need to be replaced. So it really comes down to an inventory issue, where you inventory all of your keys, the signatures, and certificates, and make sure they are of the proper strength. It is important to have these inventories in the first place. You don't really want any trusted certificates to sort of meander around your network and possibly being abused. With that comes another question, is 1024 bits really sufficient? In my opinion, no. 1024-bit keys have been broken in some cases. It usually requires sort of implementation issues in some cases, so the plain straightforward factoring isn't as much of a threat yet, but it certainly has come within reach. With all the effort involved in setting up and managing keys, I always recommend go as high as you can afford. 2048 should definitely be doable, in particular for code signing and for SSL websites. 4096, I use that a lot and don't run into any problems. So look at creating the strongest possible keys. Now, with that, let me talk about strengths and bits and keys. Let's just step back a little bit and compare sort of the different apples and oranges here, so to speak, and that's symmetric and asymmetric keys. What we just talked about is the RSA algorithm. RSA is asymmetric. For asymmetric keys, just due to the nature of the key, there is less actually random key material here because, well, they're factored primes. Now, in order to arrive at the same strength as a symmetric key, you need to use a lot stronger key. And I just put off the comparison here. That comes from RSA. I put the URL at the bottom here. But essentially, 1024-bit asymmetric key is only an 80-bit symmetric key equivalent. So that's not really all that strong. If you, for example, look at AES encryption, you would say that you want at least 128-bit, maybe 256-bit. And then you're up to 15,000 bits when it goes to asymmetric. 4,096 is somewhere in between there. It's not sort of a common symmetric key strength. But so 2048 is not really that absurdly strong when you compare it to symmetric. In addition, there are some guidance from NIST, and NIST is always very careful in researching that. And essentially what NIST is saying that 1024-bit keys should not be used again after 2013. So in particular, if you are working for government entities or such, that guidance is usually important to you. And 2013, that's next year. So you better make sure that your keys will survive past next year. On the other hand, 2048, according to NIST, that's good up to 2030. So you know, that's still, what is it, 18 years. So well, that's pretty good. Probably within the next 18 years, you have to create those keys anyway. And so 2048, at least according to NIST guidance, is still OK. If you want something that's beyond 2030, then you have to go like, 3,076 or 4,096 bits. Now, I would say anything like 2030 and beyond, the assumptions get a little bit tricky here. Do we really know how well we'll be able to break keys back then? This sort of assumes kind of Moore's law. It does not necessarily take into account sort of breakthroughs in cryptography or cryptanalysis. And that could always throw kind of a wrench into any calculation like that. The NIST document is actually pretty good. It's pretty massive, but it has a lot of sort of, you know, reasoning behind that and key lifetimes and about encryption algorithm lifetimes and such. So definitely worth at least flipping through it, even if you don't read it cover to cover. And then, well, I just mentioned algorithm weaknesses. The strongest key is no good if your algorithm doesn't work. And the last time we had sort of a big issue with SSL was probably the Beast attack. And that just happened 2 years ago, where this group of researchers essentially found an attack against SSL, in particular TLS 1.0, that would allow someone to decrypt SSL traffic without necessarily doing the full factoring. So the bit strength was not necessarily a big issue here. It was the algorithm that was the problem. At the same conference, presented by the same group, we now have a pre-announcement about a tool called Crime that, according to this group, does affect TLS 1.1 and TLS 1.2. So given the history of that group of presenting pretty solid work, we should probably be worried. Now, just a little recap about what the Beast attack is about. The Beast attack, like I said, affected TLS 1.0, and in particular, it did affect CVC ciphers, or cipher block chaining ciphers. With those ciphers, what's happening is that your data is split into little blocks. The first block is encrypted using a key. The second block is not encrypted using the same key as the first block. However, a new key is derived, and the encrypted copy of the first key is used as input to create the second key. And so it goes forth. So the third key uses the encrypted copy of the second block as input. It's not that it's just a key, but it's just that the encrypted version of the second block will be used to derive the key. Problem with this is if the attacker is able to inject plain text into connection that the attacker knows about, then the attacker is able to essentially skew this key creation algorithm to then make better guesses as to what kind of keys are being used, and then the attacker is able to decrypt parts of the traffic. Now, what they showed with the BEAST attack is that in an HTTPS connection, it's very possible to decrypt the cookie. Now, if you have the cookie for an HTTPS connection, you essentially are now able to authenticate as this user. The cookie is one of the key parts that you have to protect in HTTPS. And of course, the attacker can learn quite a bit about the cookie just by connecting to the site, like what's its length, what's its name, and things like this. And that, of course, makes it easier to derive the cookie and makes it a particularly interesting target. Now along comes the crime attack. And just a little disclaimer here, the real paper was not yet released. So some of what I'm going to talk about here is still speculation. However, I'm feeling confident enough about the speculation to put it out here and at least give you an idea as to what to look for. Right now, the best guess as to what the crime tool exploits is SSL compression. SSL has the ability to compress the entire data stream. That's a pretty attractive feature because, well, it saves bandwidth. And unlike HTTP's compression, it compresses the entire data stream. Now, with HTTP, you're able to compress an individual page, but it does not compress the headers. Also, each page is compressed by itself. With SSL compression, we compress across the stream. So data that keeps repeating across the stream can be compressed. For example, headers. For example, the cookie header. Because the server tends to send the same session cookie, or the client tends to send the same session cookie with each request. So with that, we have this repeating data that's very nicely compressed using the SSL or TLS compression. There are really two methods that are defined depending on how you exactly configure and use it, and that's FIP and deflate. Deflate is the one method that's probably more vulnerable here because it is more simple than SIP. It really just looks at repeating content and sort of tries to replace that with tokens, which then, of course, helps with the compression. What the attacker is going to do here is inject data and then see if the data gets compressed away. So if your cookie is a certain string and I inject the same string again and the resulting size of my SSL data does not increase by as much data as I injected, then I know that part of the data that I injected already existed in the stream. And of course, one of the targets here is the cookie. So with the cookie header, I'm able to check whether or not there is already a cookie header, and then I can sort of assume letter by letter the content of the cookie. If it gets compressed away, then I know I hit data that already exists. If the size of the data stream increases as I increase data, as I add data to it, then I know, well, this is the wrong data I added. I didn't guess the cookie correctly. And because HTTP does not compress the HTTP headers, the HTTP compression does not interfere here. We really just deal with the SSL compression. So here's kind of what that would look like. In blue, you do have the actual data being sent by the client. So the client here is sending just with each request the same session cookie. What I'm doing now as an attacker, I inject additional data. If the data I am injecting does not yet exist, then it cannot be compressed away. And the data, the size of the HTTPS data will increase. If, however, the data already exists, now this entire string matches, and this number 4 will not increase the size of the data. So what I'm doing as an attacker, I'm injecting session ID equals 1, session ID equals 2, session ID equals 3. With each one here, I should see the data size increasing by 1 byte. Once I hit 4, then my data will be smaller because now this entire string here, cookie session ID equals 4, can be compressed away because it showed up in the stream earlier. So I'm watching the size of the data stream as I keep changing this cookie value. Once I know the first digit is 4, then I move on to the next digit until I arrive at 8. So this is how you would play this game, and then you just basically guess the cookie one letter at a time. You can see how this works relatively quickly. If I have, and it's quite common, a hexadecimal cookie, then I have sort of a 50-50 chance of actually finding the right letter in 8 tries. So it's about, now let's say, 10 tries for each digit. If I have something like a 40-digit cookie, which is quite common, like a SHA-1-derived cookie, then it's essentially 40 times 10, so 400 different attempts. That's not a lot of attempts to actually derive the cookie. So the problem here is the attacker can determine the cookie value or other properties of the data that's being transmitted. The cookie is just sort of the most attractive target here. The effort is very realistic, like a few hundred requests, maybe not that hard. And the complexity increases linear with the length of the cookie. So it's not exponential or such. If I make my cookie twice as long, well, it just takes twice as long to guess it, which is still not that hard. And my cookie length is somewhat limited by the amount of entropy I have available to actually create random cookies. So like the 128, 256 bits, that's about as much as you can do usually. And that's considered quite strong here. And once the attacker has the cookie, then of course the attacker can log in. I put URL here that has some of this discussion, a little bit more detail. If you're interested, you can learn more about this particular attack and some of the details at this particular URL. Now, what we of course also worry about is once the news breaks, once the paper is out, what do we tell our boss we are going to do to actually fix the problem? First of all, wait. Like I said, what I just told you, I feel rather confident about, but we haven't seen the final paper yet. SSL compression is probably a good thing to consider. So one thing you may want to do now is just check with your web server, how do we actually change the compression? How do we turn it off? What is the performance impact? In particular for AJAX websites, compression, SSL compression, is quite useful because with AJAX, we do have a lot of small requests, a lot of small responses, so compressing the actual body of the request doesn't do that much for us. And we have a lot of repeated content from request to request. So SSL compression really helps with AJAX sites. And turning it off may hurt performance here. So definitely, be worried about that. The mobile sites that have limited bandwidth, that's all sort of things that can cause problems. But you have some time to test it now. So you can set up a test web server, you can, on your development server, enable, disable some of these features and see what it actually does to your site. The other thing, and that's sort of a good thing to do anyway, think about what else can you do to assist your web application in authentication. So don't just rely on the cookie. Think about maybe changing the cookie more frequently, changing the session ID more frequently. Like I said, it takes a few hundred requests. If you issue a new session cookie every 100 requests, you may make things reasonably safe here. So that would be one option. Thinking about adding like the IP address or such to your session ID, that can help. So that makes it harder to just steal the cookie and run with it and authenticate with it. But again, you know, these methods are not bulletproof. They have some drawbacks, like some people have very quickly changing IP addresses, and then this may not be a great option for you. That's why I give you some time now to actually test some of these things. And then, of course, the attacker has to inject the data somehow. Very likely ways to do that is cross-site scripting and HTTP response splitting. So these are some of the features or the vulnerabilities that you should look for. And if you sometimes in particular cross-site scripting, like I mentioned earlier, isn't really taken all that serious, this may be something that sort of bumps cross-site scripting up a little bit in your severity scale and gets these vulnerabilities fixed quicker. And that will help against other problems too. That will help against stealing cookies with JavaScript. So, you know, definitely good things to do regardless of this vulnerability. So, in essence, don't panic. Follow best practices. Take this as an opportunity to review your SSL configuration on your web servers. And make sure you also get the basics like a cross-site scripting, HTTP response splitting on the way. Out of the way. Now, of course, a speedy sort of the upcoming HTTP protocol extension, it compresses the entire request, so it may not be as vulnerable as sort of HTTP over SSL, and speedy also requires SSL. It's really a little bit hard to predict at this point how speedy will exactly figure into this. It could help to switch to speedy, but then again, your browser, only some browsers support at this point, so you can't really rely on it being used anyway. But in particular for the Ajax website, you probably should look at speedy and see if this is something that down the road you want to implement anyway. It's not quite ready yet sort of for mass deployment. There's no sort of real ready-to-go web server. You can get modules for Apache and such that implement it. And Google and Twitter already run Speedy, but it is still sort of a little bit pre-production code for the most part. And yeah, if you are Twitter or Google, then you have the resources to actually, you know, work on that and make that work for you. Anyway, so this is it about SSL. The two things are your SSL keys, review them to make sure that you don't have any of these short keys left over. And regarding this crime vulnerability, keep listening. Let's see what the paper actually says. But one of the likely things to check is your SSL compression configuration. Now let's talk a little bit about GoDaddy. Now, the GoDaddy outage, initially everybody, including myself, assumed a denial of service attack. Turned out it was not an attack. Google sort of published now a statement saying that it was a router misconfiguration. I haven't seen yet any further detail possible. They published something this afternoon that I haven't seen yet. But what it really means is you can't rely on a single provider. Yes, dShield, the website we are running, that's sort of part of the Stormside Center, does use GoDaddy and was affected by it. I look at some kind of more redundant, better setup. what it really comes down to is that GoDaddy runs a very nice, very solid infrastructure. They do Anycast, they have multiple failover servers and connectivity and whatnot else. They do pretty much everything right. However, still, they're not safe from actually doing 100% uptime sort of service. I think in their statement they said they're 99.999. So they're still five nines, but five nines still means every so often you may have a multi-hour outage like they had earlier this week. So really, what GoDaddy is already doing is Anycast DNS service, at least if you're signing up for their premium service, which is probably as good as you can get when it comes to denial of service attack. Now, but if someone configures all of them badly and something like this may have happened, well, it doesn't help you that now all of your Anycast servers are misconfigured. Well, so what else can you do? Well, probably the best recommendation, and let me just go back one step here. There's an RFC that kind of outlines how you should run your DNS service. And one thing that GoDaddy doesn't do too well is to actually host its different servers in different networks. And given that this was a routing problem, that may have been one of the issues here. So your ideal solution is to use two independent DNS providers. I do somewhat caution you from running it in-house DNS. It's really hard to get to the same kind of reliability as these large providers like GoDaddy get. So you're probably better off having someone else run your DNS servers. But for example, you could still run your own internal DNS server, and that's one of the DNS servers you advertise. So if GoDaddy goes down, your own DNS server that you run internally is still up and able to respond. Or you know, just sign up with two services. Now, sadly, GoDaddy does not offer an option that you could run another DNS service as a slave. However, GoDaddy itself could be a slave. They offer that option. So you can run the master, and then you sign up with two of these DNS services. They're pretty cheap, actually. Some of the more expensive ones run you something like, you know, $50 a month. Amazon uses its cloud offering. They have like this Road 53 service they offer, and it runs you in the order of a couple dollars a month. So it is pretty cheap to do it. The problem is to really find a service that has the complete feature set you need. I, for example, having issues finding an affordable service that does DNS sec. And affordable to me is something like, you know, $50 a year. $50 a month, you don't really have a big problem finding a service. And just to push back the point that, you know, how susceptible we all are to human error and configuration issues, just here I have two quick studies, one done by IBM and Juniper. And you see, the big part is not the denial of service attacks. It's not the power failure. It's human factors. So that's really sort of here the main issue with outages. The next study here just looks at IP networks. So it doesn't look at all really at applications and such. And again, you know, router misconfigurations are by far more important than, for example, link failures and such that we usually spend more effort. We all spend a lot of effort in, let's just say, UPSs and backup power supplies and such, when in the end, really, the guy at the keyboard pressing the wrong button is responsible probably for more failures than power outages. So keep that in mind when you talk about DNS. Try to come up with a plan where you have two independent service providers providing DNS for you. That's probably the best you can do and what you should do. And it's not really, like I said, you know, that outrageous expensive. So certainly something to consider. With that, Java updates. Now, Java never has been sort of one of my favorite softwares, but then again, you're all using Java right now to connect and to listen to this webcast. So certainly not easy to get rid of Java. Just a quick timeline of the most recent sort of Java fiasco. It started out with Java 7 Update 6, was released August 14th, was your regular patch day, fixed vulnerabilities, and all looked good. But then a few days later, FireEye reported, hey, we're seeing malware out there that actually exploits in the wild. A Java vulnerability that is as far now not patched. And in the end, it actually turns out to be two different vulnerabilities that were exploited by this particular malware. To make things, well, at least not better, Metasploit released a module that made it really easy to take advantage of this vulnerability. And then, of course, whenever we talk Java, we have the potential of multi-platform vulnerabilities. And this was the case here. This vulnerability affected OS X as well as Windows as well as Linux. So Oracle reacted rather quickly, released another update for Java a couple days after the vulnerability was seen in the wild. However, still no good. But pretty much the same day, a researcher came forward and said he found another vulnerability. Now he reported to Oracle. As far as I know, this vulnerability has not been publicly released. But what it really shows is that there is probably a number of different Java vulnerabilities still out there that hasn't been patched. I think Brian Krebs mentioned something like 31 vulnerabilities in his blog that were reported to Oracle and have not yet been patched. Yeah, and then, like I said, it's multi-platform. Now, there was a little bit of confusion whether or not Apple and OS X was affected. OS X, by default, uses the older version of Java, Java 6, which is still current, still supported. And it was not vulnerable. It had other problems. So it wasn't not vulnerable. It was just not vulnerable against that exact flaw. Now, if you run Mountain Lion, which is the latest version of OS X or OS 10.8, then Java is no longer installed by default. However, the first time you come across a Java applet, it will offer itself to be installed. And then if you don't use Java for a while, in Safari, at least the default browser in OS X, it will disable Java. So that makes it a bit safer, but also makes it a little more tricky to maintain because given that it's not a default component, you may end up with Java 6 or 7 on different machines depending on what the user installed. So what should you do? Turn off Java? I hope not. I want to keep you as a listener to the webcast. Probably the best thing you can do is don't allow Java to run automatically. Make sure the user has to acknowledge it. That way, at least if there's a Java applet on a website that the user doesn't expect Java, they may have a chance to actually avoid running it. Or whitelist sites on which you allow Java. The whitelisting can be done pretty easily in an explorer. In an explorer, you can limit Java to a particular zone, and then you can move specific sites into that trusted zone. And that can be done via group policies and such, so that's a reasonably well-manageable process. In Firefox, you do have the NoScript plugin, but that's something that's up to the user then to manage. So I'm not aware of any sort of real central management for NoScript. To require user interaction, like I said, on the Mac, you should at least disable automatic file opening after download. That's a setting in the Mac security settings. In Chrome, you have this configuration option to click to play. So this will require the user to click on it. In Firefox, as of version 14, you do have an option to actually just enable click to play. However, you do have to do it via this about config dialog, which of course is a lot harder to maintain than just a setting as Chrome offers. So disable Java. Well, the most dangerous part here is applets that run in the browser without user interaction. The JNLP file, like you download it to listen to this webcast, is a little bit less dangerous because you first download it, then you start it, so there's more user interaction. Also, you know, pre-installed software, sort of client software that you have running, you have to account for that. And then you know, definitely check your Java file signatures. Yesterday when I started the webcast, it gave me a warning. I didn't see it this time. I didn't see it today. Wonder if anybody here got a warning about an out-of-date signature when you started this Illuminate applet. Like I said, I didn't see it, but maybe because I accepted it yesterday. Anyway, it's 45 minutes in, and we are out of time and out of slides. If anybody has any questions, I'll hang around a little bit. I assume that we have a lot of listeners that listen to this as an archive because we had a scheduling issue. So if you listen to this as an archive, or if those of you listening have additional questions later, handlers@sans.edu is the email address to use. You can also go to the ISC website and then click on the Contact Us link and send us a message that way. So any questions here? If there are no questions, I would like to thank everybody for listening and accommodating our messed up schedule today. The webcast will be available as an archive, so within a couple hours, typically, you should be able to download an archive of this webcast, including all the slides and the audio. Lately, we also have made it available as a podcast, audio only. Adam will have to pull that out from the Illuminate stream. I didn't record it sort of separately as I sometimes do today because I want to make sure that we don't have any new recording issues as we had yesterday. That's it for today, so thanks for listening and talk to you next month.